This episode of the Indie Opera Podcast is sponsored by Opera America's New Opera Showcase. Experience the future of opera. Opera America's New Opera Showcase comes to historic Town Hall in the heart of New York's Times Square on Friday, January 13th at 8 p.m. This will be an unforgettable evening featuring orchestral readings of five new operas. Don't miss this unique one-night-only chance to hear excerpts of new works by some of today's most exciting opera creators. Michael DiBucci, Randall Eng and Donna DiNovelli, Julian Grant and Mark Campbell, Wang Ji and Renee Orth and Jason Kim. Performers for the new opera showcase include Sonos Chamber Orchestra conducted by Eric Ochsner and Choral Chameleon. Five new operas, one night only. The new opera showcase, January 13th at 8 p.m. Tickets are just $25. For more information, visit operaamerica.org/showcase. The new opera showcase is made possible by grants from the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation and the Virginia B. Toulmin Foundation.
Welcome to the Indie Opera Podcast.
On this episode of the Indie Opera Podcast, we're joined by Stuart Copeland. Yes, that Stuart Copeland. Hello, this is Peter, and this is the Indie Opera Podcast, and I'm joined by...
I'm Walker.
I'm Noah.
I'm Brooke.
And we're in a very good mood today. We're all laughing and happy.
I'm not in a good mood at all.
You're not?
That's why we're happy. No.
That's why we're laughing.
This is all... This face? Yeah, it's a facade.
Oh, we're just releasing stress.
You don't actually even look happy.
Thank you.
You smell happy, though.
Thank you.
So we are recording this on the day before the election, so you are living in a post-election world that we are completely unaware of, and we just hope that they're, you know, that it's a beautiful place.
I hope it's a good world. Please let it be a good world.
So we're going to pretend that we're living in the same world as you are a little bit, but I'm not saying we shouldn't talk about politics, but that it'll be old news. It'll be old news.
It's true.
News.
It's true.
But it is somewhat relevant to our topic, so it'll come back. So does anyone have any sort of leftover business from last show?
I do. I want to make a quick correction. I misspoke. Our last show, I just wanted to mention that the opera Three Way that is about to premiere at Nashville Opera coming up soon. It's composed by Rob Patterson, and the librettist is David Cody. David Cody is a librettist. He's also a collaborator of Nkiru Okoye, who we just had on the show. And he's fantastic. And he writes for Time Out. So check him out.
Cool. All right.
Okay, so no, I saw, since I last saw you guys, I saw two operas and The Human Requiem at the White Light Festival.
Oh, yeah.
Which is the Brahms, like the staged Brahms Requiem.
Oh,
yes.
Oh, cool.
Which was cool. I saw two Seria Rossini operas, and I had never seen any Rossini Seria before, and I am a convert. I never really liked Rossini before. Now I get it.
Okay, I'm going to dumb this down for the people. What? Seria?
Serious opera.
Opera.
As opposed to comedy.
What do you mean, as opposed to? Do we have to do this?
No, I just...
Opera seria, man. It's a real thing. She said it really well, too.
She said
and
it.
You were like, as opposed to... That's not nice. She's talking some serious musicological stuff here, my friend.
Wait, well, that brings up a good question, which I'm going to bring up at the end of the show. Do we know who's listening?
Who?
Do you know who's listening to our show?
No.
No. So you don't know.
That's a good point. Wait, what point are you trying to make here?
That they're going to know what she's talking about when she says opera seria.
Oh, I don't know.
No, I know a lot of...
No, this, because a lot of people...
thinking of certain people who listen to our show that's uh-huh. going to not know.
That's the problem with, like, opera seria, in a sense, is a kind of false cognate, right? Because it means something bigger than just serious opera.
Right.
God, he said cognate. Go Ooh, on. No, I'm just kidding.
Continue. No, but that was... I know, he was onto something. So
it was
no,
that's true. Wait, so, wait, like, Brooke, can you define cognate first before we go on?
No, I mean, like, yeah, there are aspects of opera seria that are serious, but it's not just that an opera is serious that makes it an opera seria, right? Right. Like, mm-hmm. you can't be like, oh, Two Boys, that was a real serious opera. Real opera seria. It just doesn't work like that.
Bruh.
I know that's how we like to throw language around. Whores that we are. Language whores.
What if something is not seria and it's also not comic?
Drama jocoso?
I don't know. Well, I mean...
drama... Ah, maybe. That, oh, there you go. That's it. Okay. Yeah.
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 All right.
Anyway.
Perfect. So what were you saying, bro?
I saw two Rossini. I saw the Mets, William Tell.
Oh, yeah. Oh, you sat through 5 hours?
I sat through the whole thing. Well, you know, I sat there and I was like, no one ever produces this opera. Right. If yep. I'm here, I need to see the whole thing. And the score... is worthy of sitting through. It rivals Otello.
Did it in French?
Yes.
They did it in French.
They did it in French, okay. So, and you, Sombre Fore.
And you didn't go on the day where it was called off because of the...
No, I saw the whole thing.
Oh, God.
I went by myself and sat in the family circle, which is an adventure in and of itself. When you go to the Met section. And you sing, yeah. or you sit in the family circle, mm-hmm. it's made up of some very odd combination of folks.
Mm-hmm. Let's break those people down.
It's so true.
So I was sitting next to...
Isn't our entire listenership composed of family circle?
People? So
guys that will stand next to you and go, well, that was a good recording of Fidelio, but I prefer the now out of print Deutsche Grammophon re-release that came out in 76. That's the guy, right? That's the guy in family
No, but they're
circle.
In the orchestra like, also. Sorry, they're in the They're in the orchestra also.
The ones who have money are. The well, ones who yeah, just...
Who are just nerds. Just yeah. To... yeah. Opera nerds.
Yeah.
So I was sitting in front of a man who couldn't stay awake, which isn't in and of itself a problem. I've fallen asleep in the opera. It happens to everybody. Mm-hmm. But he was snoring.
Oh.
And the people sitting next to me kept turning around and hitting him to wake him up.
Sounds fun.
Were you more worried about him disturbing your experience, or were you more worried about his possibly life-threatening sleep apnea?
I was not concerned that he was going to die. Oh, well, actually, no, that's not true. I was mildly concerned that he was going to die.
Really?
I actually was.
I was going to say selfish.
He
selfish.
I know I'm a selfish. I'm a
terrible
person.
It would never even occur to me.
Like, he's one of those people that like you see on the subway and you're like, is that person alive? Like,
yeah.
Is that like, do I need to call 911 right now? Or could I just leave that? So he was not, he got up during the intermissions and moved around, and he was clearly not
evidence
well.
Of life.
He gave you
proof. Seemed alive.
Like, proof of life.
Right, right, but like he was also proof not, like life. If he had died, I wouldn't have been surprised. How's that?
Would you have been disappointed?
I mean, no opinion. You know, I don't
this
really.
This is taking too long. Yes. This is the end.
That's not something that I thought about, but I've been disappointed. I mean, I don't know that I would have been happy about it. So anyway, so the score for Guillaume Tell is amazing. Mm-hmm. If you don't know it, it is really worth sitting down and listening to the whole thing from beginning to end. It rivals Otello in terms of the intensity, and it's just amazing.
Wait, Rossini's or Verdi's? Or both?
Verdi's Otello.
Okay.
I actually don't know Rossini's Otello.
You know why you don't?
Because it's not good?
No, it's not good. It's good. You need six...
tenors.
...to do it.
Yeah.
Ooh.
So...
that's hard.
Let's not do that one. Most people who are making opera say. Right.
Well, and the problem with Guillaume Tell is that the tenor role in that is just, I mean, it's amazing. Yeah. So Briony Mell was the tenor, and he did a great job. He's an amazing singer. He doesn't sing like most tenors, and you couldn't.
What does that mean?
Yeah. Mm. Please expand.
Yes.
Mm. Well, okay. So, around the time that Rossini was writing music, there was a shift in vocal technique for operatic tenors.
And Are we talking about like Jean Doresque and all this stuff now?
The French guy who started singing with chest voice?
Keep going.
I mean, I didn't know his name. I knew it was a French dude. So this French dude starts singing in a really chesty, sort of yelly, operatic style that we are familiar with today. So the very sort of heroic machismo sound that you associate with an operatic tenor, particularly with Puccini and Verdi and composers of that ilk, that developed when Rossini was still alive. And he actually said about that role that he didn't think it could be sung by tenors who were doing that. And so what I would say about Briony Mell is that he's figured out how to sort of mix like modern tenor singing with the slightly headier version of a tenor singing that was happening at the earlier part of Italian opera. And so it makes for a really, he's an amazing singer. I'm a fan. But it is a really different way of producing sound, and not everybody responds well to it. I think some of the reviewers said they didn't really like it, but I thought it was amazing.
Does it sound very different from somebody like Juan Diego Flores or Barry Banks or
specialists? I think so.
Okay.
Because I don't think that Juan Diego Flores or Barry Banks would be heard in that repertoire. I think it would be like he somehow manages to bring enough weight and color to it that Juan Diego doesn't have in the same, Juan Diego's voice that's really high. And I don't think of Briony Mell's voice as much, I think, lower, really, and much more sort of heroic tenor.
I have to listen then, because I don't know.
Have you not listened to him?
I don't know his voice.
Okay.
No.
There's a lot. There's a lot of recordings of him online. He's really good.
Okay, we got him.
The other thing I saw was Tancredi at Opera Southwest, which is also another serious Rossini opera. Mm-hmm. Also beautiful music.
Lots of serious.
Got your
Rossini.
See, we have to move on. I want to talk about that Rossini and that.
Yeah, like what's
he ate
wrong
himself
with that?
To death. There's so much left to go.
What?
He ate himself to death.
Well, he quit composing and started running a restaurant, right?
And like, he just kind of was like a gourmand and I have this whole thing about, I feel like he got lazy as a composer. Rossini's like an exquisite composer. This is what, like, he's an amazing composer who 60% of his music is shit, or recycled, that's good stuff, but recycled into shit. Like, not just like a melodist. Not at
right,
all.
No, not
like,
at all.
And not just a guy who was like not the Andrew Lloyd Webber of his day. Not that guy. Like a real composer. This man could write real stuff. You know?
Right.
Come on.
Because Guillaume Tell, Guillaume Tell is amazing.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. It was amazing. And it was, like, I was happy to sit through the whole thing. Even though I got to the opera house at 6:30 and I left at 11:30.
Yep. I think his Stabat Mater is super underrated.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
All right, let's keep going through housekeeping. You know, I thought you were going to talk about 27.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So 27 is, do you want to?
Sure. Yeah, it was great. It was by Royce Vavrek, did the libretto, and Ricky Ian Gordon composed the music. It was very beautiful, I thought. Beautiful music.
And it basically tells the life of?
The life of Gertrude Stein and Alice B. Toklas. And it featured Stephanie Blythe.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Oh,
who was cool. Unbelievable. Yeah. Because, first of all, she has to be on the stage from beginning to end. I think she left the stage for like one small scene. And she sings the whole time. And it's all, and she's the entire thread of the whole show.
Mm-hmm. And it's funny you mentioned thread. Because there was this whole theme of Alice knitting wool, and all of the secondary characters sort of emerged out of this skein of wool and turned into Picasso and Matisse and Ernest Hemingway and F. Scott Fitzgerald, and that was a creative way to do that.
And what's nice about the libretto is it was slightly Gertrude-esque. Mm. Royce it put it in this sort of verbiage that sounded a little, I mean, it actually told the story, which is unlike Gertrude. Like Four Snap. Saints and Three Acts, where you're sort of going, okay, it's all structure.
What's going on?
You it's have all such structure. You have like this combination, Peter, of like this. You will listen or pay attention to anything, no matter how weird.
Yeah.
But you slam the gates to anything like what? A little bit not story.
What do you
like,
mean?
No.
I adore Four Saints and Three Acts is like one of my favorites.
Okay.
We can go into a whole Four Saints thing.
There's a new recording, actually. BMOP released Four Saints and Three Acts. Oh. Just a couple amazing. Days ago.
We should have been Four Saints for Halloween.
People would have been going down the streets. Oh, that's Four Saints and Three Acts.
I know that. Oh, you guys are brilliant.
Oh, that's amazing.
Wish I had thought of that.
Next year, I'm going to go as Matthias der Mahler. Oh, I love Hindemith. In what world?
In what your universe? World. In our
yeah,
world.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Anyway.
But it was interesting. He did write in a way where these themes would come in that would be repeated, and the theme connected everything, just like a lot of her poetry. Okay?
Yeah. Oh, nicely done. Mm-hmm. First time I saw Stephanie Blythe sing on stage, this was a pure thought I had. My purest inner thought, like unedited thought, where is the tenor?
Oh, I get it.
I just went, oh, there's a tenor. Oh, no, it's Stephanie Blythe. I thought, because she entered like with a kind of low thing.
Yeah.
And it was so convincing.
Wow.
Yeah.
And she's always louder, like 10 times louder than anybody else on stage. It's always amazing. Yeah, like, awesome. I remember I saw her in Falstaff at the Met.
Yep, I submit,
and even in like the finale, right, the fugue, you can hear her little like,
just like tiny
over everybody.
Yeah,
and you're like, we're not supposed to really hear you right now. Yeah. She's like crazy. Drowning everybody out.
Yeah. So we should also get some kudos out there for the Collegiate Chorale, who were amazing, who sang with it, all the soloists. It was just a really great experience. And it was interesting to have that sort of mixed concert stage thing. It was really effective for me. Unfortunately, Gertrude Stein didn't die in some dramatic way. You know, I wanted, you know, it's hard to have the end of your thing is in almost every biopic, right? Well, all right, she's going to die. Mm. So the arc of the story for me at the very end, I'm like, oh, it's just sort of a light slowly fading out. Mm. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But it was kind of beautiful, the sound, and, you know, Ricky Ingorn is so interesting. And actually, you know, I haven't heard anything that Ricky and Gordon has done in a long time.
Mm.
So it was interesting to see how his harmonic vocabulary has expanded. And I had a great time. But that wasn't my news item. So let's see. We had some corrections. Some corrections. You did David Coate. The Inner Circle is actually by Daniel Felsenfeld and Kate Gale. We actually misattributed that. Also, we talked about the Tinder Opera.
Mm-hmm.
This shows you what kind of listeners we have. The producers of that listen to our show, apparently.
Oh, yes.
And I know, look at the look on everyone's face. I know this is radio. They actually heard the show, and they didn't discover us through our show notes because it wasn't in our show notes. So they actually listened to our show. And they contacted me. The actual title is Connection Lost, L'Opera di Tinder.
Ooh. L'Opera di Tinder.
And it's written as a short film. It's composed by and starring composer tenor Scott Joyner. And the libretto is by the filmmaker, who's also the director, Adam Taylor.
You're cute.
So are you.
You like bears.
I like zoos. I'm a vet, or I will be if this semester doesn't kill me.
Sounds exciting.
More like frightening.
File Cornell.
NYU.
medicine's your major.
Drinks.
Medicine. Minor.
And then after making that project, they established a company from that called the Rainy Park Opera Company. They just wrapped up filming their second opera. It's called Something Blue, L'Opera del Bachelor. It's also starring
in French.
Yeah, I know. I'm trying to say it right.
Nice.
Are they French? Or are they?
No, not at all.
American.
No. Yeah.
Yes. And it stars Scott Joyner and Jessica Felsenfeld. And that's being released this winter on December 14th with a preview at the Manhattan School of Music where they're going to screen it. So if you want to check that out, go to our website and we'll have a link to that so that you can find out more information about that. So those are the three corrections. I did want to mention the Halloween Tree, which I went to see, and that was at American Lyric Theater. Now, I know we can't review it because this is still in, as many things with American Lyric Theater are in just the early stages. But oh my God, this is going to be such a wonderful kids' opera. It's based on Ray Bradbury's short story. And I don't want to say too much about it because it's still in development, but I think this is going to be a major opera for kids. It's long, which is really interesting.
How long is it?
It's 2 hours about.
That's long for kids.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is great because the way it's structured, I know this is probably bad to say, but it's structured like a video game.
Why?
No, that's great. Why is that bad to say?
Well, it's they have these goals and they have to get these objects to I'm not going to say why they have to or whatever. But what's great about that is the kids know at the beginning that, you know, after they've made one achievement, we've got these four other to go. And it keeps their attention. You know, you're throwing the structure so that they're already safe within this is where the arc is going to go. So it really helped. I think it's going to hold the attention of the kids. It's very smart.
We needed that for sleep apnea, man.
Yeah,
right.
We needed that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's funny that you mentioned video games because I was, like, I'm a teacher and it affects my teaching. Like the big thing, trophies, you guys know about this? Like when you have an Xbox or a PlayStation, whenever you do something that's like remarkable, you'll be playing and it goes like whatever unlocked. Like killed 15 monkeys. I mean, Monkey Man. Right. You got, you know, and there's something about like your brain chemistry that gets addicted to unlocking those things.
The Wave app on my phone does that too.
Yeah.
The Waze app. Yeah. You're driving and you're like doo doo doo. You're like, I don't know what I did.
What's the one that you check in Fitbit? All that stuff is kind of activating the same like neuropsychiatry, whatever. And I feel like, you know, there's this new like framework for teaching that's been around for 20 years, like whatever some people call it, like Danielson is one name for it. And what it does is it like makes the boundaries of the lesson like really like here's what we're going to learn today, you know? So you set, this is what we're going to learn today. By the end of today, you're going to be able to do this. And then there's like the breakdown of whatever you're doing. And then there's like an assessment at the end and a way that you get like formative information about whether or not they learned. And it wrecks some aspects of teaching for sure, but it also works really well because I think new brains, young people, are very much like connected to that idea of knowing that they've done well, getting constant assessment,
right?
And video games are constant, like you're dead, you didn't do good. Like, you know what I mean?
Bad.
Like, you did well, here's a star, bling, bling, you know? Right.
So I also wanted to add that there was another Harriet Tubman opera by Thea Musgrave that we should have mentioned in our last show. So I'm going to bring it up.
She's Scottish.
And
isn't she? I think she is.
She's an American.
One of the few, very, very few Scottish composers.
Okay. So
she's married to an American, but she is not American.
Oh, cool. It's called Harriet, the Woman Called Moses. It's from 1984. I want to throw it out there just because we should have mentioned that. I mean, I should have known that.
I didn't know that.
I like T.M. Musgrave, too.
All right. So now let's just do, we'll do a nice one more round if everyone's got like small news items to throw in there. I'm going to throw mine in first. Coming on the middle of November, November 15th approximately, they're going to be announcing all the information about the Becoming Santa Claus DVD. And I thought it'd be kind of interesting to mention it now because we often talk about go see this show or whatever, but only the people who live within, you know, 50 miles are going to go see it. So Becoming Santa Claus was done in Dallas. It's a Mark Adamo opera.
Why is the queen so nervous?
None can say.
What about
court king.
When there's a queen and a prince, there's often a king.
Wish. Oh, look at the clock, the time is slipping away. Fold the napkins, buff the silver, shine the glasses, place them so. We have a party to, we have a party to, we have a party to.
Did he vanish?
What a suggestion. No, no, do not mention the king.
It's starring Jonathan Blaylock, who hopefully we'll have on our show at some point. And they're releasing that, but there's going to be more information. I'm going to have a link on our website. I know we did a whole round on Halloween operas, and there's a ton of Christmas operas, which we could probably save for the next episode. But this looks like a lot of fun, and the production I saw, the clips I have, really looks like a great thing. I'm not going to go into the storyline because it's kind of cool, and there's a little surprise at the end. So... that's my news item.
My only news item is that I've just Googled Tia Musgrave, and she's indeed Scottish. So I'd like you all to congratulate me for being so very, very clever.
Clever boy.
Okay.
I thought you were going to talk about the...
Well, that is... we're in news now?
Yeah, we are.
Oh, all right. So no, I've been tasked with talking. We all...
you've been
must
tasked.
Have
you
been,
volunteered.
I volunteered because it's so fascinating to talk about... I was going to use a bad word, but the guy, the man who canceled caused a performance at the Met Opera to be canceled of William Tell because he brought a black bag with his best friend's ashes in and spread them in the orchestra pit. So this guy, why can't you, all I was thinking to myself, why couldn't he take a Wrigley's gum wrapper and put his friend there and leave it beneath the seat? What a way to honor
it's
your
disrespectful.
Friend.
Disrespectful. Wrigley's wrapper? Come on.
Just something that's not going to be noticed.
Wait, he's dumping
why don't you
he's
put it in a box of milk dust?
Wait a minute. Okay. Oh, wait. You know? Let's start with, we gotta roll back.
We gotta roll back.
If you sprinkle anyone's ashes in a place that is regularly vacuumed, their ashes are going to end up in a vacuum bag.
Right.
But I don't get it.
It's like, the moment it's the moment they hit the conductor's stand. It's a magical moment.
I mean, think about it, though.
You know, we know it's not going to be there forever, but that life is ephemeral.
Wow, the room got so weird.
I'm sorry.
The first thing I thought when I heard that is...
pass that, Walker.
Right? No, wait. The first thing I thought when I heard this was, I know... these people.
Him?
I know these type of people.
I do too.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, of course.
I think we worked with these people.
Oh, yeah, but when they didn't say the name on the news at first, I was like, oh my God, don't let it be my friend X. I mean,
X.
I just was going, oh,
a friend named
no.
X.
Yeah.
Spanish.
He's Spanish. Yeah. Señor X.
It's Spanish. It's like a Basque. It says a Basque, man.
No, but...
Señor X.
Señor X.
Señor X.
Someone else talks.
Christ on a bike.
So we interrupted you. Go on.
So that would have been your way of doing
The
Wrigley's?
I'm the least when it comes to like terrorists. I feel like I'm like, oh, they're just going to kill us or not kill us. Whatever, guys. Like, I don't like... I get annoyed that we have to take precautions for terrorism. But if you work security at the Met and a man is sprinkling a powder in the orchestra pit, fair game.
Come on.
It's time for you to do your job.
Yeah.
You put the Sudoku down.
Body slam.
You're figuring out what that powder is, right? And that's what makes me furious about the death. This man wouldn't have had the foresight. You know he's an opera fan. He's not a dumb.
But he's not from New York, and I think that is...
And he has done it at other opera houses.
Oh, yes, he has.
This should be death.
But he's done it at other opera houses with the same guy's
ashes, or is he taking ashes?
Yeah. So this guy, I guess his dying wish was to have his ashes sprinkled at opera houses across the world or across the country. Oh, God. Yeah. And so he's done it at other places and nothing's happened. He actually, apparently, I haven't read it, but one of my colleagues said that he wrote an apology letter, which I have not yet read. She said that it was pretty she actually felt for him after
he was
mythology.
Shocked.
Selfish bastard. Isn't non-existence a big enough gift?
I mean, they canceled the last act. Okay, so first of all, the last act of Guillaume Tell is like 26 minutes, mm-hmm. right? So you sat through 4.5 hours of opera in order to have it canceled for the last 26 minutes.
No. That's sad.
That's very sad.
It was, yeah. So I was like, oh man, those poor people. And then they canceled the L'Italiana. And I just like the costs associated with that are... Like that's
People flew in from all over the world.
But they didn't give people their money back.
They did.
Really? No, they said you can. Hey,
they gave them.
I'm going to get a correction.
Vouchers for
another performance.
But that's not convenient.
That's not.
Yeah. What if you flew in from Scotland?
You should get your money back from Scotland.
and you know this is a special trip to, and that was part of your trip. You can't reschedule it. Anyway,
I don't know, man. I just think. What a jerk. I just don't like it. You know what? It just, it screams narcissism to me.
I think it came from a place of innocence, honestly. I think he just wasn't aware.
Yeah,
you know?
Naive.
But it's naive. It's naive. I mean, he should have been a little more.
He's an adult. Like, this is a grown man.
I don't think this is the only dysfunctional part of his life. That's my guess. I think the people who live next to him are like, that guy's a lunatic. Have you seen him doing? Yeah, I'm telling you. There's another side to this story.
Oh, I hope he doesn't listen to our podcast.
He's not a sweet man with a I bet he's our number one donor and he just switched all the money out of He's like, this is going turned to the, whatever, anything but
this is going to the Dallas Opera.
Yeah, Dallas Opera.
That's where this is going.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
News item?
News item. Yes, I wanted to talk about three new pieces that are about Trump, which sound kind of fun. One of them actually...
Everyone went nope with their faces. Nope.
Not fun at all.
Fun.
Not fun at all.
Anyway, yes. Okay.
One of them has already happened. It's called The Drumpf and the Rheingold.
Uh-huh.
And it's a parody. It's a 15-minute parody of the 15-hour ring cycle.
Melania now. I like things that have sparkle. I like all of my jewels. Oh, they shine.
It's by composer Maddie Kovler, and it happened at Brooklyn's Pioneer Works. It actually opened in New York, what is it, like a week ago or something? Then it went up to Boston, then now it's back. And it's about, mostly about Trump's wife, Melania Trump, but I think the three Ryan maidens are the three wives of his life.
And they actually boss him around constantly.
They boss him around.
It's actually pretty funny.
Yeah.
The other one, yeah.
But the director is Doug Fitch.
Uh-huh.
The director is Doug Fitch, and they did
how
it.
How do I know him?
He did the dwarf that I.
Okay.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
And he did it at the Blue Building, the same space.
Okay.
So that sort of interesting it feels like you're underground. The interesting sort of
bunker.
Yeah, cleaned out building.
This other one is kind of fun because it actually needs a composer. If anyone wants to compose this, it's a libretto written by Daniel Henninger, who is a writer for the Wall Street Journal.
Oh yeah, I know that name.
And they said their way of endorsing Trump was not just an opinion piece. They decided that an opera was the appropriate way to endorse him. So he wrote an opera about
Trump. Can I make a prediction?
No,
yes. This libretto will never find a composer.
It's possible. It's possible. But if there's anyone out there, no one is going to hear this because this is not going out live. But if you're out there, you have 24 hours to write
you know
an
who
opera.
Should write it because this is going to tie in with who our guest is today, Billy Corgan, lead singer of the Smashing Pumpkins, who has become a right wing.
Oh yes,
dude!
Yeah.
Isn't that amazing?
Stephen Baldwin could be in it also.
Yes,
yes.
We're already casting it.
Yes,
we're already
yes. Yeah. But it is sort of fun because there's a character called Crooked Hillary,
this guy is like really pro-Trump. He used to be a Hillary supporter, but now he's pro-Trump.
How does that happen?
He really knows both sides.
He knows, yeah. Lion Ted, Little Marco, Low Energy Jeb. And this one is
really
a little odd.
To Jeb.
Carlos Danger is Anthony Weiner.
Oh, yeah. That's his name.
Actually, that's yeah, what he Carlos Danger.
No, wait, Anthony Weiner. That was his like.
That was his. Oh, his 15
avatar.
Year old.
Yeah, 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 that was like his avatar. Yeah.
Now there's one other thing which is happening on Election Day. It's called Trump: A Theatrical Concerto. It's going to be at Poisson Rouge, and
it was at Pearl.
What? No. It's happening tomorrow.
When people listen to this,
we're in a time warp.
You cannot do that.
We're in a time
warp.
That's a kind of temporal situation.
Yeah, we can't.
No
cope
one
with
can.
That.
Anyway,
yeah.
It's by Gene.
I'm remembering yesterday's dreams.
It's by Gene Pritzker. Okay, right. And it's actually a 45-minute violin concerto. That sounds kind of cool.
That's
a Poisson
cool.
Rouge. Yeah.
What if he just played some beautiful Mendelssohn violin concerto and just sat there and listened?
Yeah.
Mm. And just it's picture like, Trump on the stage.
Yeah, that's it.
I got
picture
you.
It's nice. This is the nicest thing you could have done.
It's a soothing. Yeah.
Very soothing. But that would be
just
so
what
appropriate.
I need.
It would be so appropriate. Yeah. It was just a trick to get people to listen.
Yeah, to Mendelssohn.
Yeah.
It's a good piece. Why don't we listen? Yeah. Damn it.
Let's force them.
Yeah.
So my news item is actually really sort of heartfelt and sincere. I watched this documentary called Alive Inside, which is about using music therapy with Alzheimer's patients.
I just showed it in my class. Ooh.
It's amazing.
Did you really?
I just showed the clip of Henry.
Yeah. It is amazing. And first of all, as a musician, you're always like, what am I doing? And does my work have any value? And this is like,
really?
Oh, this is like, it's affirming that like that music matters, first of all, which is nice. But also it's a really sort of life-affirming film in general about like the nature of humanity and what it means to age and all this stuff. It is really worth watching. And I was I had heard about it like on NPR or something, and I'd sort of, you know, filed it away. It's like, oh, I should check that out. But then I met a filmmaker at a birthday party last week, and he was like, oh yeah, I work for the studio that made that documentary. And I was like, oh,
such a good one.
So then so last week I was just like, oh, I'm gonna watch this, and it's a little over an hour.
It's got Oliver Sacks in it.
Yes. Yeah. It's really good. And it's so good. I really encourage everybody to watch.
I do the same thing with documentaries, though, like ones that I feel like I can't take. Like there's this one, The Act of Killing, that's about like death squads in Bali. And I'm supposed to, that's been my homework for 5 years. Like, but I'm like, when am I ready for death squads in Bali?
Why do you want to watch that?
Because it's supposed to be amazing, and it's supposed to be like these people who killed a lot of people are kind of forced in a weird, gentle way to reconcile with what they did. And so there's something very rare,
like,
rare and kind of strange happening being caught on film.
Yeah, but like that sounds like psychic trauma that maybe one need not.
Yeah, I haven't seen it, but it's not, it'll never leave my Netflix. I'll be 90, I'll be passing away like,
see that? Yeah.
This is...
My entire Netflix queue is made up of movies like that. Like 13, you know, it's
right.
about the prison system.
13.
Oh, man.
Like,
I think I will actually watch. But, you know, then I end up watching, like, the superhero TV shows instead.
Yeah.
Of course.
Like Gotham and Jessica Jones and, you know.
It's terrible.
So we're going to interview Stuart Copeland right after this message.
Hi, everyone. I'm Brooke, one of the co-hosts of the Indie Opera Podcast, and I am so excited that we're back after a 2-year hiatus. In order for us to keep producing this podcast, we need your help. The costs of production have increased dramatically since we began in 2011, and our advertisers only cover a small portion of our operating budget. Fortunately, thanks to the generous sponsorship of Belta, Building Empowered Lives Through Art, your donations to the Indie Opera Podcast may be tax deductible. To make a donation, please visit our website, indieopera.com, that's I-N-D-I-E opera.com, and click the donate button. No donation is too small. Even $1 per episode for the 28 episodes recorded before our relaunch would be immensely helpful, a mere $28. Or, if you're able, please consider a gift of $5 for every episode for the 2016-17 season. That's just $60 to keep us in your earbuds during your commute. Regardless of your ability to give today, thank you for listening, and we hope you'll share with your friends.
He was a wanton rascal.
Prototype Opera Theater Now has been deemed the go-to spot for brilliantly produced new indie chamber opera by the Wall Street Journal. And the New York Times called the 2016 festival an explosion of boundary-defying chamber opera. Produced by Beth Morrison Projects and here, Prototype returns for its fifth anniversary season, January 5th through 15th, 2017. Don't miss new works by Matt Marks and Paul Piers, Missy Mazzoli and Royce Vavrick, David Lang and Mark Dion, M. Lamar and Hunter Hunt Hendricks, Sa Boa Aminikia, Jeff Beal, Merrick Yumjian, Sharon Nova, Toshi Reagan, DJ Spooky, and the Brooklyn Youth Chorus, Sarah Small, Cerise Jacobs, and Julian Wachner at here and four other venues in Manhattan and Brooklyn. For more information, check us out at prototypefestival.org.
De Vieni alla Finestra, Mi Tradi, and Maramina are just a few of the selections you'll enjoy when you attend Regina Opera's production of Don Giovanni. The fully staged production will be sung in Italian with a 35-member orchestra and English supertitles. Performances will be held on Saturdays, November 19th and 26th, and Sundays, November 20th and 27th, all at 3 p.m. Text your friends now and invite them to a performance. You'll have a great time in Regina Opera's comfortable 600-seat theater located at 5902 6th Avenue on the corner of 60th Street and 6th Avenue in the Sunset Park section of Brooklyn. For more information and to purchase tickets, visit their website, www.reginaopera.org. Tickets are also available at the door.
So we start? All right, and now for our guest, Stuart Copeland. Stuart Copeland was the superstar drummer of The Police, consistently voted one of the top 10 rock drummers of all time, composer of soundtracks for the films Rumblefish. I think you got a Grammy nomination for that, right? Or no, a Golden Globe nomination. Wall Street and Talk Radio, among others. International polo player. Probably most people don't know that. And now an opera composer. I was fortunate to work with Stuart when I got to direct his opera, The Cask of Amontillado, in New York earlier this year, where it was featured performance as part of the Opera America New Works Forum. His newer work that was also featured was The Invention of Morel, which has its world premiere coming up at Chicago Opera Theater. Welcome to the show, Stuart. How are you doing?
Very good, thanks.
Fantastic. Perhaps you can share with our listeners how you transitioned into opera and what you like about opera.
Well, it was a strange transition to discover it, but once in, it is the most fun a composer can have with his clothes on.
So you're saying you always have your clothes on when you're writing opera?
Mostly not.
Mostly not. I knew it.
But the real fun of it is that music really goes well with drama, with telling a story. Music is really fun to make music that propels a story. And the main way to do that is in film composing. And for 20 years, indeed, I was a before-the-mast hired gun flinty-eyed composer and picked up skills. But in opera, you really get to be the boss man because, you know, in television, the writer is the boss. In Hollywood films, the director is the boss. But in opera, the composer is boss. And I suspect that that's because with all the great operas, the composers are safely dead.
Except for you.
We are all suspiciously looking around the room at that last comment because I think, although you're right, or have been right historically, there is a trend towards kind of the director being in charge now, which is not to everyone's liking. So I hope
I'm directing.
Yeah, except for when Walker is. Yeah. That's true.
Yes. So how do you feel about that? I mean, in terms of directors, I mean, right now you're working with Jonathan Moore, someone you've worked with before. You two probably have a great working relationship. But what has it been like working with directors for you in opera?
Well, there's a codependence. Yes. He's got to have music to make his stuff feel great, and I've got to have him do cool stuff to make it look great. And I don't know how to block a scene or where to put the actors or how to use the scenery or how to use any of those tools of visual presentation. And so it's very codependent. And the two don't overlap that much. And in the difference in film where the director is boss, the director says, you know, I was looking for happy, sad, but this is more kind of sad, happy. And the professional hired gun says, yep, I know exactly what you're talking about. Just needs a little less sad, a little more happy, and then an underlying sense of doom.
That always is the spot.
And you basically make it to order. And in the course of doing that for a couple of decades, you really do learn the tools of how to make music specifically hit emotional points. Hmm. You really do get a sense of which progressions cause anxiety, which intervals are uplifting, and how to make music your slave to accomplish a dramatic feeling, you know, to go with whatever the story is.
Can we stop right there for a moment? Just because I find so few composers are willing to discuss specifically how their musical grammar affects how they write. So what do you lean on when you want to write something that's triumphant musically? Or what do you lean on when you want tension? Like, is it, what kinds of scales? What kinds
of... Well,
here's
an easy one for you.
All right.
Major seventh, you're going into a car crash. Minor
okay.
seventh, after the car crash.
Brilliant.
Huh.
That's a piece of cake.
Interesting.
Yeah, softball.
I like that.
Yeah,
are those the only two chords you use, or do you use others?
Well, here's the thing, you see. Film composing takes you to every known form of the human experience. Period romance, futuristic warfare, urban comedy, everywhere. Every kind of music, every culture, every sensibility. And so the film composer, I humbly submit, it has the widest set of musical skills of any kind of music making because you have to. In a highly competitive world, you've got to be able to supply exactly this and exactly that. And you sort of learn how to get to that, cut to the chase.
So when you were, brings up something for me. So when you were growing up, you actually were born in, or you were very young in Egypt, right? You weren't born in Egypt, were you?
I was born in Virginia. When I was born, my daddy was away on business installing a dictator in Egypt.
Exactly.
And I was shipped out a couple months later.
So your dad worked for the CIA and your mom was an archaeologist and you were in Egypt for like 5 years and then you were in Beirut. So it made me think, what kind of sound world and music, because you were talking about you have to know everything to be a film composer, what kind of music was in the streets when you were growing up and what kind of music was in your house? Like, were your parents listening to opera? Were they listening to the local stuff? What were you surrounded by?
Well, it just so happens that the mechanics of the Arabic folk rhythm, the debki and the baladi rhythms, where it was just rhythmically very similar to reggae. And I didn't really listen to it. I had my ear tuned to American radio, 1 hour of pop music, and then the Voice of America and the the BBC also ran an hour of pop music. And but the music in the taxis and in the stores and on the streets that you just heard all day, every day, because there's a lot of music playing, has this strange drop kick rhythm where they don't play one in the big beat of the bars, three, the three, four, two, three, four, two, three, four. And there's another drum which hits the upbeat. That relationship of those two rhythmic elements are actually the fundamental building blocks of reggae, which also doesn't play one and lands hard on beat three, up chicks to counterbalance that formula.
Kind of disappearing downbeat.
So in 1977, when the punk movement was looking for some way to chill, because the music was also violent and aggressive, but even punks have got to chill sometimes, but you can't play punk music slow, so they played dub reggae. So reggae became very hip in London and New York and the punk capitals of the world. And so the Clash were the first band to attempt to play reggae, but they couldn't really get it perfect. So the Police, in fact, their song was called Police and Thieves. And ironically, the Police came and thieved that idea.
Sneaky.
Do you think...
But I knew how to do the dropkick reggae thing.
Yeah, you had it.
On a very similar beat. It just came real natural.
Does Bad Brains fit in there somewhere?
Did what fit in?
Bad Brains, the group from D.C. that had that kind of reggae influence. They might have been a little later. Punk band from D.C., Bad Brains.
Oh, Bad Brains. Yeah, I remember the name. Don't recall exactly what I remember about them.
So you were ahead of the game. You already knew a beat like deeply that everyone else was just trying to catch up on.
Because Topper Heaton in the Clash, he figured it out. Okay, you do this, you do that, and he played it correctly, but he didn't have it in his DNA.
So you have this sort of reserve of the sort of roots of the African traditions, and then you moved to America only very briefly for college, right? Or did you went to London first?
Well, England for 20 years.
Yeah, and then you also hit college, then you went back to England. So you're an American, I believe, but you've lived most American of your life up until, gosh.
Well, I was an American, not in America, until pretty much the age of 18. And when I got to America, to California, I realized I've been telling everyone I'm from America. God damn it, you know.
Red
blooded. You know, holding on to an American accent. Didn't survive boarding school that well, but when I got into college, and my California buddies, you know, I've finally got an American accent back that I can count on.
But you still use some
Southern if I'm with Southerners.
You still use some Britishisms like blighter and things like that.
You know, I can't remember either. You know, when I came from Lebanon, from Beirut, when we were evacuated, things got hot there, to England, I didn't realize half the words in my vocabulary were not English words. They were either French or Arabic.
Oh, wow.
Cool. Just certain household words, you know, that you use a lot. And expressions, greetings, and salutations, you know, sort of words are not in the language of the people I'm talking to. And
did you grow up saying Habibi instead?
Which.
So where did Poe come in? Did you discover Poe when you were young? Because you've done a few Poe works.
Well, it was kind of a fancy school, I guess.
You went to a British boarding school, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was never more calm. In my life was I as strong as that whole week before I killed him.
I was calm all week before I killed him. I was calm all week like the setting sun. I was calm all week before I killed him. I was calm all week till it was done. Every night about midnight, I turned the latch of his door and opened it oh so gently. Oh, you would have laughed to see how cunningly, how carefully, slowly and silently I thrust my head in.
And so how did that happen? You were commissioned for the Cask of Amontillado? That just came out of nowhere, or how did that happen?
On the subject of polo, it was a polo chum who runs the Barbados Festival, and they've had some pretty big stars come down there. Who wouldn't go down to Barbados for a festival on a beautiful estate, and it's all very la-di-da and a beautiful thing. And so they invited me to write an opera for them, so I came up with The Cask of Amontillado.
And do you think?
And they played down there, and it was a wonderful time to be in, you know, Barbados, putting up an opera in this beautiful setting. Mind you, The Cask of Amontillado takes place deep in a cellar with the dank walls closing in and a sense of claustrophobia and suffocation. But we had to stage the thing in a beautiful Caribbean evening with the cicadas chirping and the beautiful trees lit from behind. And the
sounds like Barbados.
Wafting over us.
So I'm curious, because your new opera, The Invention of Morel, is that the right pronunciation, Morel?
Yes.
Fourth opera, then?
Five.
For your fifth, yeah. So how has your, do you feel like your technique of composing opera has changed over time? Are there certain skills that you've learned, or are you writing differently now?
Well, it's a lot more unwieldy than just scoring a film that's already there. Mm. Actually creating and being the locomotive force of a piece of drama puts a lot more, it's a lot more plates in the air. And so here I am on the fifth one, but I'm still figuring this stuff out. Mm. You know, I feel like I can't claim to be a beginner anymore. I do kind of know what I'm doing fundamentally. I've got to, you know, figure out a few of the basics, you know. But there's always new things to try, and, you know, you go and see another great work and go, oh my gosh, you know, I should be doing more of this or more of that, or... Or, you know, so it's probably the most challenging musical exercise.
So who...
Because it's so much a part of the central foundation of the work.
Mm-hmm.
So who did you go...
What makes it so fun? I'm on year three of Morel.
Wow.
Oh, wow. Three.
And it's like, you know, working with Jonathan Moore and also with Andreas Midasek, who's the... head of the opera. He's the club owner.
Conductor.
And will also conduct the piece. He sort of came in and looked at it and said, wait a minute, guys. Did you know, what about this? And what about that? We're going, what? But actually, you know what? That's a really good idea. So I've rewritten this thing. It's like a good thing I really enjoy writing opera, because I've written this one a lot of times. I've written this one a lot.
Huh.
Do you have favorite operas, or did you look at specific operas or listen to specific composers to get an idea of how these dramatic questions were going to get answered for you, or?
Well, I look at scores for orchestration, but not so much operas for the use of music to propel drama, because I come from a modern world where there are different sensibilities, and I've learned different tricks in my world of rock and roll, mm-hmm. how to hit people, how to work them up. And So although I love the works of Puccini and Verdi and the masters, and I'm uplifted by them, and I did go through a Wagnerian phase, like I guess any composer is going to go through that. I went to Bayreuth and worshipped at the shrine of the Ring Cycle and sat through hours of this magnificent music fully. But I think it's my mission to use the modern world and the language of the modern world to tell stories with music. You know, I'm still using fancy classical instruments, you know, violins, fiddles, and oboes and
but
stuff, you know.
Do you think you might make a project where the rock sound comes in more into the opera? That's really sort of a clash between, you know.
Are you suggesting a rock opera?
I don't know if it would be a rock opera, but, you know, an opera where, you know, you have an orchestra, but you also have an electric guitar and a drum set. And
well,
you know,
I got Czech, I got electric guitar and morel.
Nice. Okay, great, great.
There's percussion. The thing is that, or you know, musically, I really enjoy the symphonic instruments. You know, the word classical doesn't really apply to me, except for the tools that I use. You know, I've got shows that I do with big ass orchestra, but it's not classical music. I'm on the bill with Ravel or Schmidt or whatever, but I ain't classical. Mm-hmm. I'm just using those classical tools, which is the orchestral ensemble.
You aren't classical yet, but
yeah, someday you'll be considered classical.
Right.
Yeah, in a couple hundred years. Yeah. A lot of good that's going to do me.
That's how it goes, though.
What advice would you give if you were talking to a rock musician who wanted to write an opera? What advice would you give to that person?
Well, it depends on a lot of things. In fact, I know some people who did exactly that, but it wasn't opera. It was they went straight to Broadway, which is a much more sensible place to go if you're earning a living from this.
Yeah.
This classical, by the way, this classical thing, no way to earn a living.
Right. Yeah. We all know this. So that's why we're doing a podcast. Yeah. Because it's so lucrative.
Yeah. Better than that jazz.
Right. Yeah.
How's pop music?
Excellent.
Yeah. It's excellent.
Right here.
That's why you did pop music first.
Right. Do you? No, I.
That movie, what was it? The one about the drummer who wanted to play in the school orchestra. What was it called?
Whiplash.
Whiplash. I wanted to tell all those guys trying to get into the big jazz thing, look, guys, you know, down the hall, those dweebs playing Mozart and stuff, they're actually going to have a career in music playing Mozart and stuff. You're going to be teaching music in a school, and you're not going to be paid to play this kind of music. You'll be playing either trying to catch up with people who didn't even go to music school playing in rock bands, or teaching.
Yeah, that's unfortunately, I think, true of the people playing Mozart down the hallway, too, but I get your point.
No, not so. I've been playing with, you know, doing my various shows, Tyrant's Crush. You know, I was in San Antonio with the symphony there last week, the week before that in Buffalo with the Buffalo Phil, and playing with a lot of different orchestras in Europe and in America. That is a great career for a flautist or an oboe player or a bass player or viola, for God's sake. It's a great career, and there is a life, as, you know, in music for those people. For those,
I mean, they do pay their bills, without a doubt. They do pay their bills, without a doubt. Orchestral musicians.
Yeah, it's a great life. You're a member of those orchestra players, or the orcs, as I like to call them.
The orcs. Oh, yeah, the orcs. Can you tell us a little bit about...
Like a giant, they're like a tribe. It's sort of like they're the faculty of a very elite private college which has no students.
Tell us about the invention of morel. What attracted you to that story?
Well, I was going to do Finnegan's Wake. Fortunately, that's a very long story, but fortunately I didn't. And then went from that to how about a very slim volume?
Yeah.
Which can be described as a sci-fi romantic black comedy period piece.
Okay.
What genre did I leave out?
Romance.
But it's fundamentally The Invention of Morale, so it's sci-fi.
Uh-huh.
It's set in a time which makes it a period piece. It is a black comedy and also a romance.
Oh, you do.
Mm-hmm. Not taking any chances.
You're pulling everyone in on this.
So I know that you've done a lot of sort of improvisatory work with classical musicians.
No, classical musicians do not improvise.
No, I watched this video.
Okay, there's one thing. Yes, actually, I stand correct. You're quite correct.
I watched a video. it was Stravinsky, Rite of Spring, actually, that I watched. And maybe it was not actually improvised, but it had an improvisatory feel to it. And so I wonder if you have considered or tried anything improvisatory in the composition of any of the operas that you've written, because...
Well, the mission to which you refer is called Off the Score.
Yes.
And I collected an ensemble of classical musicians who normally read the page. They're musicians of the eye. Their whole musical experience derives from what their eyes tell their fingers to do. But they desired to cross into this mysterious, dangerous world of improvisation. Jackie Kimura Parka is one of those pianists who parachutes in to whatever symphony to play your big piano concertos. Yoon Kwon is first violin at the Met. And two other guys of similar caliber on bass and EVI, the strange instrument, Judd Miller and Marlon Martinez. But we play a bit of Ravel, a bit of Stravinsky, some Prokofiev, and indeed we play pieces based on these works, but then we go off and we do our thing. And for the classical musicians, jumping off the edge is like, oh my God, I can't believe I'm going to... Ah! They go off and their fingers are whirling, and it's like a real joyride.
Wow.
It's actually pretty exciting.
It is cool. Like, I enjoyed this, watching this afternoon. So,
have you heard... I'm just curious if you've heard the new recording of The Rite of Spring by The Bad Plus?
Well, it's tricky because the Stravinsky estate is very crabby about carving up the rights.
Oh, okay. No, there's this jazz trio from Minneapolis called The Bad Plus, and they just recorded, I think, 2 years ago. Just thought maybe you'd have something to, if you've heard it.
Well, right about the same time, there's something in the zeitgeist. Several people came up with the brilliant idea of carving up the rights.
What do they do?
They play the score, but they play it amongst three people.
Oh, cool.
And it's, I mean, I've only listened to it once, but it sounds like they kind of get it all, you know? And there's a looseness to it. So it doesn't feel like a strict transcription or anything, but I just thought it sounds
Jackie,
a little like...
Kimura Parker, he can do it just on piano. He's figured out how to do it with 10 fingers.
Yeah.
Jeez. Wow.
And it's pretty exciting because it's like Leo Kottke on his guitar. There's multiple fingering techniques. He's got so many things going on out of one instrument, and you can hear all these different voices within it, and it adds up to the similar effect. You know, Tombo de Couperin just on a piano.
Oh, that's an awesome.
That totally works.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Are there any fantasy projects you're thinking about, Stuart, in the future that you're just mulling over that you haven't started yet?
I have a couple things in the cookie jar. And no good idea is wasted.
Okay.
Well, I mean, a lot of times, particularly in film composing, you end up with things on the cutting room floor, but instead of I regularly sweep my cutting room floor and you know, put it all in the cookie jar. And because things might not be relevant to a scene, but that doesn't mean it's not a really cool little theme or cool little line that you've discovered.
Well, thank you so much for being with us, Stuart. It's awesome to have you here.
Well, it's been fun chatting.
Or at least your voice. I trust that you're wearing clothes right now as well.
Yes, mostly.
All right, take care, Stuart. Thanks a lot.
All right, thank you guys. That's been fun.
Thanks for calling us.
Thank you.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye now.
there are people whose names show up on everyone's top five, top 10 drummers, like Neil Peart and who's the guy from Led Zeppelin, John Bonham. Right. But Stuart Copeland's on everyone's list. Almost always. And then the other one that is, and this is really amongst true like drummers for some reason, Ringo Starr.
Oh yeah.
People talk about like, it's not about fills or about special equipment. It's about just that guy just played like genuinely and beautifully, you know? Yeah. So anyway, so maybe we can get Ringo Starr on. Is he writing an opera? Shining Time Station, the opera?
Nah, I don't know. Let's do a final round, Robin, before we say goodbye. Any last thoughts?
No thoughts here.
No thoughts. Oh my gosh. All right. So I'll do mine.
Okay. All
right. Well, it's not a news item. It's a round robin. So, round robin. Just a little thing about the kind of people who listen to our show. We can't really get Google Analytics like you can on a web page on our podcast. So we really don't know who is listening to us. Who are you? And I spent this weekend, this past weekend here at the National Opera Center with the Producers Symposium, where they had opera producers, but also people from across the country doing other disciplines like puppetry and things. And I was trying to think about what is our community? Who are we serving so that we can make sure that we are also reflecting what people want? But we don't know who those people are.
Basement dwellers.
Yeah, they could be that man who's falling asleep in the balcony. It could be the ash dumpers. But we don't know who you are. So
send us an email and tell us who you are.
And even if it sounds that you think we don't want to know about your life.
No, we do.
Actually, we really do.
Actually, one of the best ways I like to find out about who's listening to our podcast is by getting a donation, because then I really remember who that person is.
Yes, right. That's absolutely actually true. I know the names of all of the people who've given money to the show.
They're inscribed on your heart.
They are. Yeah. They're
literally, because you tattoo their names.
I do on your heart. Like, that's I have a list.
That's a bad
list. Listen, I'm being totally sincere here, though.
We are
as well.
I actually don't have a tattoo, though.
All right, but no.
Does anyone have tattoos here?
This is not.
Are we a tattoo free podcast?
I have one inside.
Oh. But no one will. That's just your gallbladder.
Okay. It is like herding cats.
The anarchy.
I like watching Peter get nervous. Everyone's talking.
The anarchy has spread.
As if we can't edit it all. Yeah.
No, but I'm being completely sincere. I want to hear. I mean, I know we have opera professionals, and it's great to hear from the opera professionals. But I'm really curious about who. Are we? Who's listening to our show? Who we don't think is listening to our show? Who are the housewives, the doctors, the lawyers, the people we don't know about?
Kings
and the king, the kings and queens,
sultans.
All of them. Mm-hmm. So I just want to encourage you to please just send us an email at comments.
Tweet us
at
Facebook page
at comments at Indie Opera. That way we can get a conversation started, because I would love to just get to know who our audience is. So I'm putting that out as my final thing. Did you remember your
no,
last?
No, I got distracted.
Okay, that's all right. This is gonna be a long show. No, there's so much great stuff on it. All right, thank you for listening. I hope some of this podcast made sense to you.
Yeah.
Good night.
Good night.
Thanks,
good night.
Everyone. Bye.
If you're new to the Indie Opera podcast, go to iTunes and subscribe. That way our show will be automatically downloaded to your smartphone or other media device. And please rate our show in iTunes. It's a free way to show your support. We love our subscribers. The Indie Opera podcast is recorded at the National Opera Center and is produced by Peter Zepp with co-hosts Noah Lethbridge, Walker Lewis, and Brooke Larimer, and with support of Chuck Sachs, associate producer, editor Ross Crean, who also created our theme music, Sharon Apostolou on social media, with recording engineer John Lind. Thank you for listening.
And I know that women love flowers.
Got Stitcher? We are on it, so get it. Stitcher is an award-winning provider of news and talk radio for your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio.
Close to my heart, but mysterious with the living silence of the rose. Much too